This podcast, I'm going to delve into some of the science of beer. I'm going to eventually get to some of the quantum mechanics of some of the molecules which support the bubbliness of beer. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. Similar to other multi-part podcasts, it takes a few podcasts to give a sort of background information and eventually dive into the more interesting science. And just looking at people tend to like the traditional science, where things don't go too far out of the things that they're familiar with. But to understand anything scientifically, you have to just quietly listen to things and actually get a more deeper understanding of what's going on. So I'm going to try this as part of my podcasting skills to go some greater depth into it. So look, there's a fundamental seed. Basically, you put seeds in water and let it ferment, and then you get beer. That's how the Neanderthals and ancient Egyptians made this brew. So they were storing some seeds and yeast, which is single cell funguses, eat the sugars and proteins, convert those sugars and proteins to alcohol and carbon dioxide. They actually break down the hydrocarbons and carbohydrates and actually produce a little bit of alcohol, which people like, and break down the products. So similarly, we do certain things with seeds. So a seed of a barley plant is a two-component thing. There's the actual embryo and the endosperm. The embryo grows up to be the plant. The endosperm is this packet of protein glue, proteins, and in that protein glue are little globules of starch. And this expands with water when you add water to it, and the seed will germinate and start to grow. Now, this is important. One of the beers I want to discuss is Guinness, because this is sort of a beer which is on the edge, and science has actually grabbed it and put it into pubs and put it into cans and stuff like that. And there's a lot of science behind this more gentle beer. Now, I suppose beer is basically seeds in water fermented, and then about 1,000 years ago, there was a few major changes, and then you've got that fermenting process. How that fermenting process goes: so fermenting is a time where the yeasts are encouraged to grow, and they do their work, and that fermenting stage goes for a certain amount of time, is stopped and controlled, and the yeast is generally killed off, so you don't have a yeasty, it's not actually fermenting in your mouth. So it's fermented and ferments up to an optimal alcohol flavour period. So you make your beer, and your beer is made at a particular quality, and so when you drink it, it's a known a known taste, known quantity. So when you order a particular beer, you know what you're getting. Now, let's get back to a grain and water. A grain which is mashed up and then made into a glue, and then yeast again to bubble up, and you eat this gluey sort of endosperm, baked endosperm. That's pastry or bread. So a beer is another liquid form of almost liquefying grains. So you can have bread and beer. Beer is a natural way. And part of the beer brewing process is putting antibacterial stuff, and we'll get into that, into the beer water. So the water is relatively pure. It can be controlled, but there's a heating and various processes, which means that you are drinking sanitised water. So drinking beer is a way of getting drunk, everyone knows that, but getting pure water, which is not full of microbes, which have a simple system of going from the environment into the host and then out of the host again into the environment. The beer process is sufficiently complex that all of these microbes haven't evolved to survive some of the processes there. I suppose you've got a lager. So lagers are cool beers. So this is, imagine, and the yeast ferments towards the bottom of the lager barrel, I suppose. That produces, which is a sort of a common, your Fosters and things like that, your average Carlton, you know, brewery beers are lagers. So you just throw your barley in, mill it up, and let the yeast go for it at a fairly lower temperature. At a higher temperature, get your stouts, which is from the Old English, I believe, strong beers, and I've forgotten what the class of beers, beer is porter. So you've got your lagers and your porters, and your porters, you've got the stronger beers, which are the stouts, and these are fermented with different yeasts. So a yeast is not the name of sort of like cats. You've got different varieties: Persian cats, Siamese cats, street cats. You've got mongrel cats. So if you just have some water out, a yeast molecules will just go into it and get all different types of yeasts. Yeast coming in. So you've got your selected yeast, which people conserve and control. These are single-celled funguses. So just to get an idea of what a fungus is, you've got I'm just trying to think of the term for eukaryotic cells. These are more complex cells. It's got a nucleus, and it's an archaic cell, which is evolved and taken over and is enslaved bacteria. That's what eukaryotic cell is. It's a slave-owning cell, and so it multiplies, but it also, in its multiplying, multiplies its slave bacteria. And this type of cell has evolved into eukaryotes themselves, single swimming eukaryotes, there's also funguses, plants, and animals. So a fungus is sort of a cross between a plant and an animal. It's not non-photosynthetic. It actually is a animal which, well, it's a fungus which exists on decomposing plant material or animal material. It will come in and actually start to wreak havoc and dissolve and eat it. So it's not associated with life of getting energy from the sun or from hunting live animals. It's purely the an animal of the dead, so to speak, looking at it. So we have these funguses in. So the stouts or porters are top brewing, the top fermenting. That is the process of eating the sugars, the carbohydrates and the starches in your barley is processed at the top and at a higher temperature. And also it's not just barley, it's malted barley. So what is malted barley? What's happened is I've just paid attention at the Royal Easter Show and asked questions a little bit, so remember these sorts of things, and then just brought it together to my final understanding. I'm bringing it with you. Perhaps you know this already. I really haven't chatted with the people. I speak with a lot of people and I don't know. So it's in the malting process. What is a malted process? Well, you get your barley and you sprinkle a bit of water on it at the right temperature, and you get it to germinate, which normally would be a dreadful thing. And you get the little baby plant growing a little bit, doing some chemical reactions and starting to just germinate. So basically when you fertilize your embryo, it goes in a suspended animation state in your plant, sitting up the top there, sitting on top of a large first baby formula meal, ready to go. And it's put in a special package, ready to fly in the wind, attached to break up and attached to various things, and go, be transported to a new place, then be watered in the right temperature, sunshine, and say, yep, I'm ready to go, but obviously not growing on top of mum and dad. It's growing a distance away. And this should actually sort of stop now and talk about the cereals which made wheat and barley. So normally this would be create havoc to harvest this type of stuff. So when it's ready to go, it all falls off and flies everywhere. So what happened is that a long time ago, 10,000 years ago or more, some varieties of wheat and barley, etc., the mutated and didn't fall apart. And so this was a godsend for hunter-gatherers, because rather than actually going around like a chicken picking up the individual seeds, they could go over and pick up the seeds. They'd actually forget to migrate. So there's a lovely kookaburra just sitting opposite at the moment. So this mutation happened, and man was about the place and said, that's great. And then they saw the seeds and said, well, why don't we actually plant some of the seeds? And that gave basic agriculture as we know it. So we've got the barley, and the barley process is going for malting. And obviously we don't want to actually eat alfalfa sprouts or anything, or baby bark. I think there's a certain point in time where it's actually... I didn't know there was a little snake in front of me that this kookaburra's eaten. Okay, so the barley is stopped, and there's a interesting process that it's stopped. And this process, I don't know whether there's some sort of chemical fermenting process of the barley at this point in stage, but then the barley is roasted. And so essentially you can cook the proteins and cross-link some of the proteins and actually toast your barley. And so the toasted barley adds the colour to your beer. And basically your beer is actually going to be alcoholic when it ferments and tastes like seed stuff. So we're getting towards the Guinness. So the Guinness is a stout, a porter beer. It uses malt, and it is your general beers is general processing, but in that orbit of beer production, this is going down one evolutionary path. So you've got your malt, and essentially the nutritious components of your malt is actually going into a liquid form rather than making it into a bread bun. You're feeding it to someone with beer, and the yeast has had a bit of a chew out of your bun first and actually converted some of the yeast to alcohol and carbon dioxide. But indeed the carbon dioxide's used to be stored, but it's not necessarily stored off the process. So it's not like champagne where you bottle it and the fizziness goes in. This is an industrial process where you have to grab carbon dioxide and reintroduce it. But it's your initial Guinness that's produced. Okay, we have to go through the hops. So it's barley and hops and water. Okay, you add and a whole lot of and yeast going through the hops. So go back 1,000 years or so. People needed something to condition the water and to add a bit of flavour. So I think they just went around the place picking up bits of pine bark, any sort of herb, mixing it together. You know, obviously people who found the best herbs mixed it together, ground it all up, chucked it in the beer, added a bit of flavouring until someone struck upon this creeper. It's a small vine that creeps up along vines. So it's a ground plant, and it's not enough support to grow itself. It requires a tree to grow on. Or nowadays we have a central lockdown place and going up on two support ropes in a V shaped is all. Oh, that's what I can remember seeing, a V shaped, and the vine creeper goes up along it, and the pod produced, the seed pod produced by this, has a whole heap of properties, antibacterial properties, acid properties, gives the beer basically its beer flavour. If you felt beer is a bit bitter, it's the hops flavour, and hops add all those flavours. And I'll just talk about hops for a little while. So hops is one of these plants where you've got, looking in my back of my head, I think I just remember the plant spirals around. It's a bit unlike grapevines, which didn't send out tendrils. It just basically hooks its way up, and I think it's clockwise. It goes around, and when it goes up, there's a male and female plant, and in general you would think that you want to get male and female plants, and obviously the male plants are not going to be that interesting because they don't produce seeds and storage systems, so obviously there is this flowering vine called a hop, the flowering vine goes up, and in general you want, once you've got a good hop variety, you just want it cloned. You don't want any of this genetic variation. And in fact, one of the things you have to do is get rid of your male hop plants, because your male hop plants will fertilize your female hop plants, and you'll get lots of hop seeds. And essentially, hops are made out of unfertilized hop flowers. So it will go through forward, and if it fertilizes, it's bad news. If it does fertilize, it goes up there. And in ancient times, people would go around with, let's go out and harvest hops, but nowadays I think they just rip the entire plant down and rip out the hop seeds. So it's a little hop cones, and they're ripped out, similar to cotton picking. I think there's something very similar to the cotton picking. So this is sort of, it's beer making has gone from a cottage industry, and it's got complex over the years, and now it's gone to big industry. Now, what's happened in Australia is we've, like our Chardonnay, we've stopped drinking our Fosters, and we drink boutique beer. So the beer drinking of Australia has dropped by half, but it's even worse. We're now almost exclusively drinking foreign boutique beers. Not the old. I remember going to a footy match, a Collingwood versus Carlton footy match in the 70s, and just seeing this rain coming down from the underneath of the stands, and it would be just the beer just dripping down, people just drinking Carlton beer and all that type of stuff. So obviously the hops and the malting process and the boutique beers, people are getting a bit more attention how the beer is made and the hop process. Now, with hops, they're dried and milled, because the hops are produced at one time of year. They have a growing season, so they're a vine, so they grow up and flower and die. And so the hops are are roasted as well, I think, to improve the flavour. And there's a lot of improving the flavour. So the malt is fairly stable. The hops are the secret ingredient that you can add. The recipe of beer is getting those hops correct. And I'm sure there's a lot of boutique beer makers who source the hops. So there's a way to mill the hops and get them in a hopper. Hops are put into a hopper and added to the beer, infused through the beer, like a flavouring of the beer. You know, the important thing that where hops beat the bits of stick and twig everyone used to pick up, and it wasn't truly the actual people had recipes. Where the hops did is they've got natural antibacterial agents, which actually clean up. I can't really believe, when I thought I was going to speak about this, I really didn't remember I had all this information storing up, because I want to get to a very important point. Point about it. So the hops are the antibacterial taste stuff. So if you've killed off the bacteria and you've heated it and you've stored it for long enough, the sort of bad bacteria which is going to cause a disease hasn't got a hope. It was evolving, but it wasn't evolving to kill apes who are going to make beer with it. You know, that's not part of the process. Okay, so we're getting up to Guinness. Guinness is sort of my beer with a bit of science and technology has come along. So Guinness is not strongly carbonated in terms of the actual fruitiness. Just sort of fruitiness gets lost if you make it very acidic with a whole lot of carbon dioxide. So it's got a small amount of carbon dioxide. In the old days, when all beers came from barrels, it was okay. But the lagers, which were made with a whole lot more carbon dioxide, had their automatic delivery system. You put it in a key, and with the carbon dioxide in it, it would just jet out of your keg as the carbon dioxide. You throw in a bit more dry ice, it didn't matter, it was absolutely chock-a-block full of carbon dioxide, and it would come out and be saturated with carbon dioxide, your lagers. And so the great thing is that you could roll it down underneath the pub, stick a pipe into it, and then have it on tap. So that would take a whole lot of logistics there, the keg variety. Now, this is something I've picked up from speaking to people. These pipes and things have to be methodically cleaned, and it has to be cleaned every couple of weeks, completely cleaned, because they start brewing their own beer. You know, your beer comes out and it starts to go off. And there's been occasionally some pubs where they've run out of money and not done this for a couple of years, and then they have their loyal drinking clientele, and then they come up and they clean it, and people say, what's happened to the beer? They actually get acclimatised to the yeast, which actually grows, this wild yeast which grows, and there's these pubs around the place. I don't think there's many of them left, but these family pubs, and allegedly you taste the beer and it tastes of that pub. That's because they haven't cleaned their beer stuff. So Guinness had a problem in that its beer didn't have enough gas in it to actually push it up the tubes to come on a tap. And so they came up with the idea of actually, rather than putting in more carbon dioxide, they actually pumped in more, I suppose originally they would have pumped in more compressed air, but then the oxygen and other rubbish in there would be, and carbon dioxide is there. Sorry, and so they put in nitrogen, and nitrogen compared to, this is our first piece of physics here, nitrogen is N2, 2 14s is 28 U. Now, not grams, but U, because the unit of mass for a molecule is the unit of the unit. That is, not of the gram, but of the unit. So in science, we have a unit with a called the unit, and it's got a symbol U. This replaces AMU, atomic mass units. It's just replaced with U. So it's got 28 U versus carbon dioxide. And in my head, I have 16 and 16 and 12 is 44. I can't really add it up in my head, but I think it's carbon dioxide is much heavier. And the dynamics is that the carbon dioxide bubbles are less buoyant, and they go through a process of growing bigger, and your nitrogen bubbles are much smaller. So what happens is that they had this technological innovation to get the Guinness out, which had a particular taste, was just a standard stout. But this technical innovation meant that when the beer Guinness is poured out, the nitrogen, which is less you can store as much nitrogen as you want at sufficiently high pressure, but it stays less. It's chemically less, and this is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm aiming to do, is to go to the interest in quantum mechanics of how carbon dioxide is in there, but we're just doing the nitrogen at the moment. The nitrogen comes out of the beer in a couple of seconds, and so what happens is that when you pour your Guinness, it initially goes cloudy, and as the nitrogen bubbles come out of your beer and actually start to float upwards, your beer goes from this white, cloudy stuff as the nitrogen begins to come out very quickly and go up forward. Now, I might do another one. There is a problem of nitrogen dissolving in your blood. So if you go down, breathe nitrogen in a scuba diving tank and go down too much, the pressure comes too much, and you go up to the surface, you'll have the Guinness effect inside yourself, and that's called the bends, an incredibly painful thing. Now, nowadays, the kids don't sit round on Saturday and watch Jacques Cousteau and all the descriptions of it. I very much doubt that people would know that the divers deep would actually go into a pressurized diving bell, which would increase the pressure, and they'd take it up into the ship and gradually reduce the pressure over a long time. And also the little Americans going down in the deep sea diving submarines would replace the nitrogen with helium, because helium would be less, I don't quite understand, because helium dissolves in your blood a little bit less than nitrogen. Carbon dioxide dissolves really well, obviously, and there's amongst your blood a special globular proteins called carbolase. It's designed to make the blood really good at dissolving carbon dioxide and vary the pH and reduces the carbon dioxide non-hemoglobin version of hemoglobin. There you go. It's a globulin, hemoglobin. Now I've forgotten what the iron. Maybe zinc in the carbon dioxide or magnesium. One of those is the chelating iron in your carbon one. But essentially, you can have the Guinness effect in your body for free by going to depth in the ocean and coming up too quickly. Your blood will have the same Guinness effect. It's actually a bit painful. And again, I can sort of remember back in the 70s or 80s seeing movies of people in deep sea bell divers, and they have helium gas to allow them to not suffer from the bends as much. I don't know if it's true, but it's interesting because there were a sequence of watching these big chunky sailors going, "Hey, you got a big mouth?" You know, that very high helium voice. So we're up to Guinness. We've poured out Guinness, and what happens is your nitrogen comes out of solution very quickly. It's not held there chemically; it's held there by physics. And we haven't discussed the. We'll discuss the quantum mechanics of carbon dioxide going in, and it rises up small bubbles. They've adjusted the surface tension and the molecules at the top, so that it forms a very thick head of the of basically nitrogen, tiny nitrogen bubbles, and this is your head on Guinness. So your original Guinness before this nitrogen couldn't have had it, but now people have got this phenomenon. It's got this bit of a science which fascinates the people. So people, there's a bit of skill in pouring your Guinness. So the head grows up to a certain height, and obviously they, when they're making, manufacturing the Guinness, they check it that it goes up to a certain height from the factory, so the customer sees it goes up to a certain height. And this foamy stuff doesn't have the sort of the bitterness. It's got the foam, a bit like a cappuccino in a beer. So that's your Guinness. Well, what I want to do is that then they had the problems of Guinness was the, I think it's an IPA, Indian Pale Ale. There you go. I don't know what the Indian is, but Guinness is for some reason called an Indian Pale Ale. That's just off the top of my head on that one. Okay, so you've got the process. So Guinness had a few markets, a few world markets that were successfully marketed, and then they broke into the pub market with nitrogen. And then it meant that they couldn't get into the homes because when you had a bottle, a can of Guinness, and you just opened it, it wouldn't have the same high-pressure nitrogen in it. And so it comes along the real great invention. I think this is an amazing invention. It's called the Guinness widget. And so inside each tin, they drop in a what's like a ping pong ball with a small hole in it. The size of any Guinness tin. Your Guinness tin is slightly taller because it's got to have this extra volume in it. And this is empty. And then they squirt in some liquid nitrogen, supposedly. And then they pour in some beer. So they pour it in together, and then they seal the beer. So it's a pressure vessel. Now here, as I've asked people, I'm not exactly sure what's going on, but I think in this process you've got to pressurise beer and the air at air pressure inside your widget. It's just a ball with a tiny hole in it, and the beer would be a beer and nitrogen would, which is outside the widget, would force its way into the widget. And what I think, this is just my guess as a scientist looking over it, that the important thing is that the beer is pushed as a jet, and if it's pushed as a jet, compresses a jet and expands into your lower pressure stuff, it will be chilled, and being chilled and atomized, it's got the high surface area to pick up, to start to breathe in the nitrogen. And so what will happen is that your beer being pushed in will entrain the nitrogen and tend to store the nitrogen in and beer inside this widget. Now, I would expect that over time, if you've got a small hole, the nitrogenated beer, which I expect to be heavier, a slightly different density, would eventually diffuse. So I think, like, and I've had a few embarrassing times where I've had beer and I've offered it to friends, and they've looked at it and they've said they haven't printed this label for a while. Indeed, the beer will be a couple of years old. I wouldn't have picked it up, and apparently beer does go off. So I would expect that a can of Guinness would have a shelf life, depending on how it's held. And then to get this, you have to have the Guinness chilled for a while. Now, the interesting thing is they specify you have to chill the Guinness for a fair amount of time before serving it. So it's not just you watch Guinness and you whack it in the fridge so it's cold. It's got to be sufficiently cold. So I think it's sufficiently cold to chill the actual nitrogenated beer inside the widget. And it comes the time you've chilled your beer, you crack open your Guinness. And I haven't done this. I've never had a Guinness. And with taking heart medication, it's getting a bit complicated to work your way through to how much you can drink and when you want to drink. So it's more the science, which is fascinating. So what happens is that when you open it up, you release the pressure. Your nitrogenated beer has got the pressure stored in it, and it will your ping pong ball will actually start to jet out highly nitrogenated beer through its little hole in a circle and just keep on going. So I think at the end of the day, if you're really going for it, so this will release the nitrogen as it would do in a pub. Beautiful piece of Irish engineering. They've decided world's problem. We want to actually give you Guinness in a beer can. It's a great thing. We've landed a man on the moon. Now we've got beer in a can. So this ball jets around, stirring itself around. It's heavier than it's a plastic which sinks in beer, and the ball lasts at the bottom, and it will have this nitrogenated beer, and it gives the nitrogenated beer, stirs it around, comes out a certain amount of time, and the nitrogenated beer comes out of your ball within a certain amount of time. Obviously you don't want it to still knocking around half an hour later while you're still drinking it, the small nitrogen bubbles form. It would go cloud in your can and form a head within your can, or you could pour it out of your can if you have to open it up and pour it out relatively quickly. Otherwise the head would form in the can, and you'd have to open it up and pour it out relatively quickly, I would expect. But you'd have to pour it out sufficiently slowly such that the nitrogen out of your widget would continue going along. Now, I'm not sure on this, but if you want to get your full amount of Guinness, you'd have to rip open your can, carry a cup open your widget, and drink the small amount of Guinness still inside your widget. So I think the widget would still have some beer in it. That's just my guess. I haven't actually done it. I don't know whether it's half nitrogen, three quarters nitrogen gas. It's a whole lot less carbon dioxide. The nitrogen really doesn't add anything to the beer. It's more a propellant, a propellant with the bonus of producing a small bubble head. But it doesn't. It's a nitrogen is an inert. It's a triple bonded, basically inert gas. And the inert gas is a problem for nature. We've had a major problem of nitrogen. Nitrogen is the stuff of proteins, building blocks of life. It's nitrogen, carbon, nitrogen, as I've said before, and proteins. And so we've got a major problem that nitrogen is really good. So we have had to wait around for lightning to break the nitrogen apart, and then special bacteria in the soil which can actually fix the nitrogen, that is, break the nitrogen bond. So that is a major problem in life. And so in the beer making, the Guinness experience, nitrogen is just basically a method, it's a physical thing to get the Guinness from underneath the pub into your glass. And you see this phenomenal effect and you say, that is Irish, even though it must have been invented only relatively recently. And then the Guinness out of your can is worthwhile. Look, I'm really not advertising Guinness at all, and it's just the background information I'm trying to get across before, on another YouTube, I'll discuss the carbon dioxide or CO3 carbonate molecule and the implications of that. The thing is that if you do understand the carbonate molecule, you're on the way to understanding solar cells and batteries. It's one of these things which is the food, it's the fizziness in your Coke or your Fanta. Thanks for the Germans during World War II for inventing Fanta. to understand what's going on. It's a food, so people are automatically interested in it, and that's what I want to discuss. So, again, I suppose the take-home message here is that although there's a great thing to understand the most exciting part of science, there is this solid asking questions. You know, what's in beer? Barley. How is barley related to malt? So that's the barley's germinated. Hops. What are hops? Oh, well, hops were invented 1,000 years ago. They're a flower, but they're an unfertilized female flower. Oh, I should mention that Australia's got a little bit of hop production. We have got none of the hop pests. We've got none of the viruses, none of the little bugs yet. And please, tourists, when you're coming along, don't bring a hop plant as a gift. Gift here, or infected hop plant. So we've got a little boutique beer industry in Australia with these fantastic hop plants, pure hop plants growing. The Americans and overseas, they have to absolutely douse their hop plants with chemicals, and of course that gets eventually into your beer. So Australian beer, boutique beer, is again as beer was meant those 1,000 years ago, that sort of more natural, more organic, more organic beer. I'm not paid by the beer organisation. That's just because I know about this. I can't remember where I picked that piece of information. Oh yeah, biosecurity. You've got the FBI. We have biosecurity, and these are all farms. And often when you go farms, you have to walk through washers and put your feet in these washing baths and stuff like that. I don't know how effective biosecurity actually is. I just think we're very isolated, small market, a long way away from things. But getting back to it, we've got the malt, the yeast, which eats the malt, the hops, which are all cooked up, the chemical reactions there. And then finally the stouts, which are more food than actual beer. There's carbon dioxide in it, a bit more a sweeter, more flavoursome beer. And then a whole series of technological problems, technological dead ends. So Guinness was never going to get into the pubs. Then to get into the pubs, and now, hey, look, the nitrogen is part of what Guinness is. It's that beautiful head and the colouring. And then, look, it's not going to get into the homes because it's not in cans. But then they've invented the widget, which is sort of mind-blowing, the actual science of the nitrogen and the beer getting into the widget, storing it like that, and then coming out of the widget in sufficient time. As a customer, drink some beer and think nothing of the technology of it. And perhaps if I've given you anything, that when you buy this, you'll be able to open up your can, get the widget, cut open the widget and get a tiny little bit of Guinness, which was for free. I think they still charge you for the total number of millilitres, the weight in the can, but they would never tell you about it. I don't know whether they do that. Look, thanks for listening. Eventually, we'll get on to the quantum mechanics of carbonate. Very interesting thing to get on. I've sort of been looking at the carbonate is a polyatomic. That is carbon, oxygen, three oxygens. But somehow it's able to actually support stably two extra negative charges. What's going on there? Really, that's something you should contemplate, is the quantum mechanics of drinking beer. Thanks a lot. Thanks for listening. And I'll get another podcast out soon. Thank you.